Hi there, this is James Tripp. Welcome to this hypnosis conversation I've built this as. It's a two-way conversation we're going to be having here, but mostly I'm going to be asking Adam a bunch of stuff because he's got some fascinating things to say, some fascinating perspectives. He's done a lot of fascinating research around hypnosis, self-hypnosis, and how it works. So I'd just like to welcome onto the call the wonderful Adam Eason. Adam, are you here?
Hello, I am here. Thanks very much, James. It's very lovely to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me on this call. Of course, the reason you're here is because not only are you a top chap across the board, of course, I recently was very privileged to see you speak, open up the Change Phenomena Conference for Head Hacking.
Yeah.
About 3 weeks ago, was that now? Maybe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm really fond of that particular event. Simply because what I have found, and I'm guessing that people that have been immersed in this field have probably found the same, and that is that there is a lot of dogma entrenched out there. A lot of people whose original training is something that they're incredibly loyal to and faithful about, and sometimes feathers get ruffled with the amount of diversity and different perspectives that are offered up from different sections of frontline hypnosis professionals. There's such a contrast in perspective, such a contrast in levels of adherence to evidence, for example, and what professionals find important to know and understand. And one of the things that I loved about Change Phenomena was the fact that I was encountering people that I kind of vehemently disagreed with, yet was going out for beers with and making really good friends with, and the amount of respect and professional respect and friendship that was built across such a wide range of diversity meant that I really loved speaking there. And sometimes, I've been amongst audiences where some of the things that we're going to discuss this evening, for example, really get people's backs up. And, it's not meant to. It's meant to form an adult discussion and debate. And I think that the Change Phenomena Conference is one particular place where that thrives, and that mature, grown-up attitude seems to thrive with regards to debate and discussion and so on.
Mm. And that's... I guess something that perhaps we have in common. I know I used to certainly get people's backs up. If I still get people's backs up, they're a lot more quiet about it. But one of the things that really struck me, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to invite you on here is because I found myself nodding in agreement with much of what you were saying. Many of the, I think there's some overlaps in our views of hypnosis. I'm sure there are some differences as well. And I know that we've come to this from very different directions probably as well. And of course, there were some things in what you were saying that were real kind of eye-openers and really quite enlightening for me. So I'm quite excited to give people here the opportunity to hear some of that stuff as well. But before we get into that, before we get into your current views on hypnosis, how it works, how it fits together and all of this, I would love to know how you got into hypnosis in the first place, and I'm sure people on here would love to hear that as well. How did you get into hypnosis? What was the history of your journey with this?
Well, there are certain if I were to flick through the pages of the book of my own life, there are some chapters which I probably would look upon as being fairly dark times. Of course I have some halcyon eras in there, but as a younger man, there were certain facets of life that I really struggled with, so I had a number of issues that I wanted dealt with, and such was my bent that something seemingly alternative seems to really, really, really appeal to me. At a similar time that I was seeing some challenges, my best friend in the world, my younger brother, was also, and he'd had some wonderful results with a hypnotherapist. This hypnotherapist was somebody who helped me greatly and also ran training courses. And so back in 1996, I trained to be a hypnotherapist with a school and a hypnotherapist who taught a very particular model of hypnosis, that the conscious unconscious model, And I worked according to that model that hypnosis was a unique state, and you know, it was bypassing the conscious mind to access unconscious resources and so on. And based upon that model, I wrote a book, and I wrote a book about self-hypnosis adhering to that model, which propelled my career greatly. To this day, it sold more copies than any of my other books. Didn't have any evidence-based quotes in it whatsoever. And I wrote this book back in 2004. At the same time, I was looking at starting to run training courses myself. The course textbook was a book by the updated versions were written by Michael Heap, and that was the Heartlands book. It just so happened that whilst reading the Heartlands book, someone said to me, you know, if you're going to teach conscious unconscious and you're going to teach that hypnosis is a state, they'd only think that perhaps you ought to give a rigorous read to the core text you're recommending, and pointed out a lovely little quote, although at the time it was a very bitter pill to swallow. A wonderful quote. Over 100 years ago, this was quoted by philosopher and psychologist William James. And what he had to say about the unconscious mind was that it was the sovereign means for believing what one liked in psychology. And he said something along the lines of that the field, rather than becoming a science, the notion of the unconscious mind was turning it into a tumbling ground for whimsies. And you know, I felt hurt at this. And still today, despite the fact and the good that it did to my book and for my career, The Secrets of Self-Hypnosis, Harnessing the Power of Your Unconscious Mind, is something that I'm probably slightly embarrassed about today. And as I started to read that particular book, and as I attended some other trainings, I underwent a vast transformation. I read about the cognitive psychologists and neuroscientists that were disputing the concept of dualism, you know, the mind being distinct to the brain. I read about a wide variety of different models, and suddenly, what I fell in love with was the fact that instead of everything having to be about artistry or having to just be about things that I consider to be intangible, you know, purely working with the mind, purely working in with a certain special state that had never seemed very tangible to me, suddenly I was confronted with this idea that, albeit very, very sober, I absolutely fell in love with. And the cognitive behavioral hypnotherapy model is something that when I teach it today, that the reconceptualization of what hypnosis actually is something that people find very, very challenging to take on board initially. They often have no idea how on earth they're going to almost radicalize their client work to incorporate it. But when they've properly had a good read of it and a good study around it, and they see the evidence that supports it, I tend to find that there's no going back, so to speak. It's very difficult, because one of the things that I did enjoy about this the earlier the embryonic phases of my career in this field was that I got the opportunity to be eclectic. You could cherry pick across the board of all these different things that related to the trance model. I could use all kinds of stuff to do with NLP. I could do all kinds of stuff to do with different forms of hypnosis. I could do regression. I could do all kinds of different stuff, and got to cherry pick. And suddenly this particular model was saying, well, actually you ought to be questioning quite a lot of that. And that pretty much brought me to a number of years, nearly a decade now, and you know, of the sort of 16, 17 years where I've earned my pay wholly from hypnosis and the field of hypnosis, the last sort of 10 years or so have been really dedicated to a slightly more scientific stance and approach, a very, very sober approach, which a lot of people dislike altogether, you know, me whipping the magic away. But I often respond and say, well, you know, rather than attempting to sell the magic, why not present the ordinary and let people discover that there is very, very much a lot of magic to be discovered within that ordinary, and the results can absolutely be interpreted as being magical.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that really, when you were talking about that change phenomena, that really resonated with me, because this is one of the things when I was initially teaching hypnosis without trance, I had almost a guilt about on some level, was exactly that. And I used to call it ripping the magic away. And I felt guilt. In fact, the last hypnosis training I ran, a woman ran out in tears saying, "You don't even believe in hypnosis." You know, she was really upset by some of the things that I'd said. But again, for me, it's, and I think you put this in a beautiful way, it's like, it's not magical, but when you get into what's actually going on, when you understand the, you know, the power there is within our everyday cognitive processes and faculties, at least this is my take on what you're saying, there is magic in there, and we are capable of incredible things.
Absolutely. And this is key to me. See, rather than offering something intangible, or rather what I perceived to be intangible, and you know, things that seemed to have an air of mystique about it, which is what so many people love about hypnosis when they first get involved. And, you know, it makes you interesting at parties and so on, you know, but instead of, you know, offering that up in the first instance, I'm offering up as a reconceptualization, a rather sober perspective that hypnosis is not actually an alternative state or a special state or an altered state of consciousness, that actually it's an active process, that it is a cognitive process, and it is a positive mindset built upon and out of attitudes and expectancies and so on, and that you develop it as a skill. You know, that when suddenly presented with all these things that are just ordinary psychological processes, and that initial magic that people were after tends to evaporate. Yet, you know, rather than overselling and under-delivering, I prefer this notion of soberly underselling it initially, telling people what it actually is, developing it, and then them realizing, in fact, when they've got this skill, this ability to go out and apply to vast facets of their life, that actually that's where the magic is. And instead of overselling, we end up over delivering with that magic. And it's something that, you know, ethically sits well so nicely with me, and it feel, you know, it makes me sleep far better at night.
Now that's an interesting thing, that idea of underselling it and over delivering, you know, the under promise and over delivering. It's a concept I'm always fascinated by, and for me it took a long time, and I think that you're probably further down the road with this than I am. And what I'm talking about here is how you frame hypnosis, what sometimes people call pre-talk and this kind of thing. I was always, for a long time, trying to find ways of being honest about hypnosis, at least honest from my perspective as to what it is, while still keeping the magic in there, because I'm aware of the power of the magic as a thing in and of itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, well, the placebo effect of, there was a study you mentioned about CBT having a higher efficacy rate when framed as hypnosis.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I mean, not only did Stephen Lin do a study the notion of cognitive behavioral processes and the effect that labeling them hypnosis had upon the efficacy of it, but also, you know, much earlier than that. I mean, I'll come on and mention that again in a moment, but much earlier than that, Theodore Barber, the very famous and prolific hypnosis researcher, in 1964 and 1965 showed that simply labeling a situation as hypnosis greatly enhanced responsiveness to suggestions. Because, you know, it was Barber that showed that there was no kind of hypnotic phenomena that was exclusive to hypnosis. And I think some of your own work and some of your own demonstration has shown that actually people, you know, anything that can be achieved with hypnosis can also be achieved with suggestion, albeit to a lesser or perhaps less amplified impact. And when Barber conducted some treatments and some experiments, one set of subjects were told that they were part of a hypnosis experiment, and those in other groups were told that they were control subjects, and i.e., you know, they were having nothing in particular done, and they were just measuring the effectiveness of placebo within the test process. Now, once the research scenario was framed as hypnosis or control group, the remainder of the treatment was carried out identically, and absolutely the same for, you know, throughout these groups. And it, in both of these studies conducted back in the 60s by Barber, people that were told they were within a hypnosis experiment showed a gain in suggestibility as compared to those who were told they were control subjects. And as a result of that, it means that modern day hypnosis research has always attempted, in order to demonstrate the out and out efficacy of some of the treatments, they've attempted to remove that and remove expectancy and attempt to make things blind. And, you know, with my own PhD work, it's quite interesting when you talk about blind studies, because my own particular model that I adhere to with hypnosis finds that people are much better hypnotic subjects when they know they are being hypnotized. And so, you know, a lot of people sort of send a critique my way very often and say, well, you know, there's not many hypnosis studies that are blind or triple blind and so on. And you know, how do you answer that criticism, Adam? You know, in order to adhere to the evidence, you know, surely you must understand that that's a critique of it. And I'll say, well, potentially a double blind study would be detrimental to the hypnosis, because if you consider that belief and expectation are so vital and central to a cognitive behavioral model or a social cognitive model of what hypnosis actually is, you know, believing in what they're doing and understanding what they're doing, then surely it would be detrimental for them to be blind to that fact.
So I'm curious about where you're at with regard to how you frame this with clients, because, as you say, you used the word sober before.
Yeah, absolutely. I educate clients with some written information prior to them coming and seeing me, and offer them up some of that sobriety. Essentially, my first introduction when I'm talking to them about it is that, and I'll build upon the seminal work by R. White in 1941, in his article, which, you know, a preface to the theory of hypnotism by R. White, before he got into the lemonade game. And he was speaking about hypnotic behavior being meaningful, goal-directed striving. And from White's perspective, hypnosis essentially becomes a verb rather than a noun. It's a skill rather than a passive state. It's something that the subject actively does rather than something that automatically happens to him or her as a result of a mechanical induction ritual and suggestion. And would say that to some extent, I mean, not universally, but to some extent, that all hypnosis is self-hypnosis or a process of self-hypnotizing. You know, in order to respond to suggestions, one must engage their own imagination, one must engage in their own cognitions, one must believe in the responses that they're likely to attain, they must have a certain expectation and belief, they must have certain attitudes towards hypnosis, they must be motivated, they must have a certain depth of their role involvement, they must have some sort of goal direction with it. And so essentially my own education of my clients is a combination of explaining those things and at the same time punctuating assessment and orientation with hypnotic skills training. And hypnotic skills training is something that we'll speak about today, because it's vital as far as the self-efficacy is concerned, and it's vital as far as advancing hypnotizability is concerned, and so on.
Okay, so that's interesting. I'm gonna pose this question again in a slightly different way, which I think reveals some of my own concerns around things. So one of the reasons I was deeply fascinated with your approach. Do you ever feel that by making it more sober, you reduce the kind of impact and the buy-in of the notion of hypnosis, the power that it carries in and of itself, by saying, you know, it isn't that, it's this. It isn't that magical thing, it's this sober thing.
Well, you know, look, yeah, I mean, people say that to me. You know, if someone presents a certain belief system in hypnosis, why don't you just ride into town? Why don't you just surf in on that? And because, you know, it ends up being ill-informed and it doesn't fit in with the rest of my approach to the therapy. Because an other model would render the vast majority of the process fairly impotent from there onwards. You know, if hypnosis is simply meant as a set of attitudes and behaviours that mediate hypnotic responses rather than an altered state of consciousness or hypnotic trance, or in other words, I'm saying to clients, hypnosis does something, but hypnotic responses don't seem to be anywhere near as special, dramatic, or abnormal as is popularly assumed. When ordinariness of hypnotic responding is properly understood, actually it becomes wonderful, because it's no longer something that I am needed to somehow wield upon this person. That actually they're about to discover things that they can do for themselves. And as you develop hypnotic skills, you know, hypnotic skills, some of which you have demonstrated beautifully yourself, you know, card stick, hand stick, name amnesia, and things along these lines. When you show people, and catalepsy and things, you know, within one particular session, that actually, if you apply this sober model, look at what the hell you can do. Look at this very, very clever stuff. And suddenly, you know, again, we've undersold and we've over delivered with a lot of that stuff. And yet we don't need to then make a correlation between all these amazing experiences they're having and some intangible special state that there is no real evidence to suggest exists.
Mm. And you don't feel that, I feel like I'm labouring this point, the soberness of the framing, it doesn't, in your experience, undermine the ability of people to manifest.
No, quite the contrary. I think the opposite. I think because, the collaborative nature of it, the working together, the soberness of the skills make them easy to apply, make them tangible, make them real, and, you know, able to touch. People still, you know, regardless of this, will still very often, encounter unusual types of sensations and feelings. It's a funny thing, you know. I mean, I have people from all over the world that buy some of my audios and send me some of the most crazy shit you ever heard, you know, about, whoa, man, you know, I was tripping balls listening to your audio recently, Adam. People all over the world saying these kind of things, thinking that means that they were hypnotized. When actually, if you sat on your own in a quiet room and just concentrated heavily, and, you know, evidence would suggest that you're likely to have some of the same types of spaced out experience. People do report a variety of subjective feelings during hypnosis, although they are less dramatic and less frequent than is probably assumed. But they, you know, they tend to be correlates of suggestions being given to a lesser extent, but, you know, perhaps to a surprising degree. Control subjects in studies who are simply asked to sit with their eyes shut for a similar period of time without being hypnotized also tend to report unusual feelings. I'm going off on a slight tangent now. The point I want to make here is that, no, I think if you offer up an honest, sober account whereby hypnosis becomes an ordinary psychological process, but you show them that when equipped with this ordinary psychological process and the way in which it can be applied to such a wide variety of different facets of their life, that actually it becomes doable. It becomes something that's very achievable, something that is now a transportable skill and not just purely dependent upon this random guy you've had to pay to be present in order for you to do that. And I think that is far, far more empowering and client-centered. And, you know, I've noticed people in a very busy hypnotherapy practice that I have responding quite the contrary to that which people may think.
And I think, you know, for me, that's really exciting. That was the thing that excited me the most in listening to your presentation at Change Phenomena. Because I know for me, I do less and less hypnosis change work these days and more coaching. And the reason being is because I really value, and when you use the term self-efficacy, I believe you pronounce it slightly different from me. I say efficacy, you say, what do you say?
Efficacy.
Efficacy, right?
Yeah, clearly I have issues.
Yeah. I don't know who's right there. But when you mentioned that, I was like, yeah, because that's where I'm at. You see, I had this thing for a while. I started getting this thing with hypnosis, like, is this really empowering my client, or is it reinforcing this idea that the power is outside of them somewhere, i.e. in the hypnotist or in a special state called trance? Or conversely, the power is inside of them somewhere, but their unconscious mind. Or something like this, you know.
Yeah, can I add, I just want to add to that. You see, what I consider to be a really important consequence of this is that the role of the hypnotic subject becomes demystified. It's made more easily learnable. And now, cognitive behavioral theories of hypnosis have already led to the development of experimentally supported procedures for hypnotic skills training. So, as I was talking about earlier, there's a wide number of different approaches, but the most extensively researched is undoubtedly Nicholas Spanos's Carlton Skills Training Program. And hypnotic skills in training involves socializing the subject to the role of being a hypnotic subject and collaboratively working with them and training them in specific cognitive and behavioral strategies using models, using coaching, using trial and error learning opportunities. And this approach has been repeatedly shown to increase hypnotic responsiveness among initially poor responding subjects. So from a clinical perspective, the potential significance is there that we can turn bad or initially poor hypnotic subjects into good ones. And surely the benefits of that are strikingly obvious. I find it a real challenge to accept, you know, when people are saying to me, you know, there's only a certain percentage of people that are going to be able to respond to this, that, and the other, yet that absolutely isn't supported by any empirical evidence. Yet what is supported is the fact that hypnotizability, responsiveness can be affected. Of course, you know, not everybody is going to be excellent at everything, okay? You know, for people that have met me, for example, you'll probably see I don't exactly have the physique for ballroom dancing. Okay, now there are people out there who probably have certain traits that are going to make them naturally better ballroom dancers than me. However, if I practice and practice and practice and practice and develop a skill, I'm going to get better. Okay, I might not be as good as some other guy who's a bit more nubile than I am and a bit more responsive to fake tanning, but the thing is, you know, I'm going to get better in and of my own, and this is what I'm talking about here. You know, of course there are going to be certain people who are likely to be more responsive as a result of the kind of traits, you know, and these traits are probably discussions for another day and another kind of discussion. But the point is that it's been shown that the hypnotic skills training enhances hypnotic responsiveness. And surely anybody that is a therapist using hypnosis, you know, can understand the benefits of that rather than just condemning someone to being responsive or not.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a really exciting thing. Now, what I'm also interested in, I'm gonna flag this now, but then pull back from it. I'm also interested in the specific hypnotic skills and how they serve the clients in their life outside of the therapy room. If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing. But before I say that, I just want to get one thing we haven't done. I think you have done this, but we haven't flagged it up clearly. Is what is your definition of hypnosis now? Now, if you, you know, to put it in a nutshell, how would you, what's your one-liner? I know this is a heck of a thing to ask, but you probably have a kind of a one-liner that is your nutshell description. What would that be, your nutshell definition of hypnosis?
The hypnosis is a positive cognitive set. So hypnosis can be seen as, or rather, subjects who are motivated to be hypnotized, confident in their ability to respond, optimistic about the process, and who expect to automatically experience the responses being suggested will tend to respond better, because that is the mindset of hypnosis. So to be more specific, a hypnotic cognitive set is how I reconceptualize hypnosis in terms of a bunch of attitudes. And they tend to be derived from research on problem-solving orientation, as well as the social cognitive model of hypnosis. I mean, given more time, I can give a far less concise version than that, not very concise version anyway, where we talk about the specific attitudes required and things along those lines. And that generally tends to be about attributing hypnotic responses to themselves rather than an external hypnotist or an unconscious mind. Tends to be able to estimate the demands of the situation favorably, you know, considering these things as being good. And that's important, because there's a lot of misconceptions and myth and so-called dangers of hypnosis that could potentially inhibit responses that people, you know, are committed and are aware of their own control, and that they have a degree of response expectancy. But yeah, I mean, in a nutshell, a positive cognitive set.
Okay, so a positive cognitive set, a hypnotic set, and that cognitive set is a certain set of attitudes and orientations and these kind of things.
Attitudes, expectancy. So motivated to be hypnotized, confident in their ability to respond, optimistic about the process, expect to automatically experience the responses being suggested. That's probably the core of the positive cognitive set. That makes up, that are all ordinary psychological processes that make up and contribute to hypnosis.
So the cognitive set, I think that's important that you said that they're psychological processes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, hypnosis is absolutely a verb, according to this model.
Yeah. So I'm going to chuck in my definition of hypnosis here, which I've been using for a while, which is the use of language and communication to direct attention, lead cognition, and seed ideas for the purpose of leading somebody into an altered perception of reality, which I think probably overlaps.
There's a number of aspects of that really sing in tune with what I've been saying.
Hey, that's good. We can slap each other on the back over. So now, self-efficacy?
I think you probably say it correctly. I think I've probably just got into a bad habit. I say it so often.
Yeah, as do I. I've got no idea. I've got no point of reference. It's one of those words that I probably started pronouncing when I'd only read it and made an assumption about the pronunciation, and maybe that's close, maybe not. What would be your definition? Because we're using this term, self-efficacy or self-efficacy, but some people listening to this might go, well, what is that?
Based upon really good, solid evidence and research by Bandura in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and more recently, but the sort of crux of the theory was put together in the 70s and the 80s. And Bandura said that with sports people, for example, as well as in therapy, when people believe in their ability to achieve certain outcomes, they actually do it. So they actually are more likely to do it. So that is, you know, when people doubt their ability to do things, they become poorer at actualizing the outcomes that are required. So, you know, there's a certain degree of one's own self-belief that then advances our ability to actualize the outcomes that we're after. And, you know, within sports, we tend to find that when people, you know, heck, you just look at elite sports people and the level of conviction and belief they have in themselves and their own, you know, very often it's self-efficacy that makes the difference. A really interesting thing that study by a guy called Matt Fitzgerald, who looked at Ironman athletes, and said that, you know, physically and physiologically, they were virtually identical. And what was making the difference was, you know, that their conviction and their level of belief in themselves and so on. And self-efficacy is just that. Now, within this model, it becomes quite important because this is so collaborative, this model. And that is that, you know, virtually every induction that you do, you hand over to the client as a self-hypnosis induction for them to practice. And likewise, there's hypnotic phenomena and hypnotic skills. I mean, even if you look at the 1920s work of Emil Coué, you know, Emil Coué rejected heterohypnosis, rejected the most famous Nancy school of hypnosis at the time, because he said, look, you know, when I give heterohypnosis inductions, people could just refute them. And so he said, therefore, let's get people to convince themselves. Let's get people to use auto-suggestion, as he entitled it. Let's get people to use auto-suggestion, say it with belief, say it with conviction, and to make things their reality. And Emil Coué, as I'm sure everybody listening knows, is the guy that coined that famous affirmation, every day in every way I am getting better, and so on. But he also used imagination experiments. He's the guy that created this idea of putting a plank in the middle of a room and everybody finds it very simple to walk over it. But if they imagine and convince themselves that that plank is perched between two skyscrapers, that actually, you know, their imagination begins to get in the way and create a lot less fluency. Likewise, what he then went on to do was create and construct a number of imagination experiments, such as hand being stuck in a chair, hand being stuck to the leg, and simply saying with belief, without effort and without anxiety, simply saying with belief, I will move my hand, but I cannot. I cannot. And just convincing yourself. There's a certain degree of self-deception that's involved. But and Coué would say, you know, go away and practice this. Practice this. Get it as a fine art. And what would happen is that, you know, same with more modern cognitive behavioral hypnotherapy, hypnotic skills training, is that by practicing these things, they're developing the skill, obviously, but they're also beginning to see their own progress, which therefore begins to build self-efficacy. They're also beginning to notice success, which make notable steps in the direction of their main therapeutic goal, which builds self-efficacy. And, you know, they're developing and seeing with their own eyes something very real that they are creating. You know, in the absence of the therapist, when skills are developed, you know, they're showing, you know, heck, I'm doing this. And so, you know, self-efficacy exists in those terms as far as this particular model is concerned. And I just think, you know, when I started out and wanted to be a therapist, you know, I had this kind of rather ethereal sort of dream at the time, which was, you know, that I encountered so many people that had dreams or desires for themselves and wishes and outcomes with very little capability of how to do it. And one of the things about the kind of state model, and one of the things about the, you know, I'm doing hypnosis to you model, was that, you know, it didn't seem to be, you know, it was more about kind of me doing something to that person. It didn't seem to be wholly collaborative. It didn't seem to be wholly equipping that person to go out there and believe in themselves, you know. On the contrary, they were being led to believe that they must have me, my presence, in order to create really effective hypnosis. And instead, with self-efficacy, you know, via hypnotic skills, these people have some conviction of themselves and a conviction of belief in themselves, and have real life evidence that they are responsible for creating so much wonderful change. Fair enough. Some of it may seem a bit metaphoric, you know, sticking hand to my leg. But at the same time, the cognitive behavioral hypnotherapy model, you know, equips people with a wide range of therapeutic skills as well. Mental imagery processes, cognitive restructuring, and behavioral techniques and strategies. You know, then, heck, I can't put that into a nutshell. But, you know, there's a wide range of other things that they engage in and get better at, which serve them as probably, you know, more useful life skills than sticking their hand to their leg.
Yes, and that's one thing that, you know, I love, I'm very much in love with. I came into hypnosis from self-development, from being a committed self-changer, from experimenting with different things, moving my mind in different ways. And I've got very good at doing it. I'm very, very good at self-change. And that's always provided a contrast for me when I've done hypnotherapy in the past. I've always had this desire for people to be better at self-transformation, you know, and this is where, I've always wanted this to be the case, hence the reason moving across more and more to doing coaching and that kind of thing. I often found that people would come in with a very much, well, I've got this problem, can you fix me, can you do this, can you stop me smoking, can you, or can hypnosis, does hypnosis work for this?
Yeah.
And I always say to people, you know, hypnosis doesn't work for anything, but you can use hypnosis.
Yeah.
This change, if you want to do it, it's the hypnosis isn't going to do it for you. But if you want to utilize this as a tool, you know, this can be a really powerful thing. But it's a
absolutely
tool.
I think that's really on the money.
Yeah, and I, you know, so I really like that approach as well. You mentioned also metaphor there, and you know, so it can be a bit metaphorical, but I don't think there's anything problematic with that. I think metaphor is such a powerful teaching thing. A little bit later, I'd like to talk to you about Erikson and Ericksonian hypnosis, which I know you've got some interesting views on, and then we can make some real enemies.
Yeah, and absolutely. You know, it's at that point that people start hanging up and sending me unpleasant emails.
Yeah, but I'm going to say something. I'm not. You know, I've got a big influence from Erikson, I suppose, in the stuff that I've learned via NLP. I've never really gone deeply into Erikson and his approach himself directly, his own approaches. But I've, you know, had a peripheral interest. One of the things that I remember Jeff Zeig saying about Erikson was really that Erikson was all about getting messages across through experience, through experiences. He wouldn't just tell you something. He would want to create an experience, something memorable, something that was going to take that message in deep. And hypnosis was just one of the ways that he did that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that can be a really useful thing. So often I'm quite fond of hypnotic phenomena as vehicles for other kinds of learning, if you see what I mean, just as means of teaching somebody something. Or even, for example, and I'm going to talk about NLP here. If you take stuff like NLP submodalities processes, I think they're not that strong when you treat them like ways of reprogramming people. If you just move around the elements of someone's internal imagery or aspects of their feeling set or whatever, and you just move it around and claim that that's reprogrammed them, you can sometimes get some results from that. But there's not a lot in the way of self-efficacy. But when you have people move their submodalities around and notice the difference, and they pay attention, and then what I'm more interested in doing is have them learn that they can move things within their mind and make a difference. Not to say it's a perfect reprogramming moment or it's going to do this, but look, you have this capacity. When you're aware that you can do these things inside of your head and make a tangible difference in your, you know, in your experience from doing this, they go, wow. And I've found that that's a much more generative way to work with some of the kind of NLP processes and things like that. You know, I'm interested in anything that teaches people, hey, I can do stuff here. I can make a shift. I can make a change here. Now, I know you're probably there going, NLP, and I know you've got a view with there being no evidence base around that. And that's another thing entirely. Have you heard of Paul Tozzi, by the way?
No, I haven't.
Paul Tozzi is a guy who's actually got an expensive book out on a critical review of NLP and looking at the evidence base for it and starting to work towards some evidence-based research in NLP, which is an interesting thing because...
Well, I mean, the wonderful things about NLP is that, you know, a lot of the strategies and techniques are you know, ideally placed to be tested. You know, they are things which can be tested. Heck, you know, I once saw Irving Kirsch speak, and he spoke about the fact that no matter how many times they attempted to reproduce the sort of results that people were getting with the fast phobia cure, they just couldn't reproduce them in a sort of research environment. And you know, I heard an interview with Richard Bandler and was saying, well, you know, these techniques are not supposed to be used in a research or a laboratory type of setting, and you know, disagreed according to that. Whenever I mention this, you know, whenever I mention it, even when I say, look, you know, it wasn't me that was saying it; it was Irving Kirsch that was saying it. And you know, and Irving Kirsch is the man that's done more research in the field of hypnosis than any other. What tended to happen was that people would really dig their heels in and say, well, look, I've had amazing results with this. I've had amazing results with this, and that's that. So shut your face, Adam. And get really offended by what I said. And, you know, it's certainly not a slight. It's not intended as a slight. But what I often tend to find is that the degree of belief that's been invested in that process, in that technique, via trainer, via, you know, the school, via the field, because sometimes I think the field of NLP has a bit of a siege, you know, or probably requires a bit of a siege mentality, that, you know, let's circle the wagons kind of thing, and people dig their heels in and support it. And I think that degree of belief that the therapist or the practitioner has invested in the process, you know, and then the way in which they congruently deliver it tends to potentially carry the therapy, and that the client believing in it so much. Heck, that's just one particular example. You know, I know some and have friends with a great many NLPers and people in the NLP world. And, you know, I really hope they begin to and are able to have some research that will support them and shut people like me up.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, things are going to start going that way. I know Paul Tozzi is very, very keen. He attempted to recruit me a number of years ago as part of a group gathering data, and I just wasn't up for it at the time. I wasn't interested. I had a kind of a different view from what I've got now, which was more like, well, I'm an artist, and I just do my stuff, and when rolls. And I still actually have to admit I do have that view, but one of the things that I do advocate is that people do follow up with their clients and they do question their own assumptions about things.
So absolutely. Engage in reflective practice. You know, examine what you are doing. Have a really good, solid look at what you're doing and how you are doing. I think this is, you know, I think this is absolutely essential.
Yeah, and I'm very interested. You know, one of the things, a line I used to hear a lot about my own work and other people's work was, oh, yes, it was really good for a couple of weeks and then, you know, or it was really good for like a month and then, you know, and sometimes people are going, yeah, man, it's been great. I don't know what you did, but that juju you did to me 3 years ago has been fantastic or whatever, you know. So there's a different range of stories. But I've also... You know, I've had the uncomfortable conversation with many hypnotherapists and NLP, the how do you follow up with clients conversation. You know, what's your protocol for following up? I've been told all sorts of things. I've been told by one representative of a particular school of hypnosis that it is unethical to have any contact with a client after your therapy time is finished. And I'm thinking, and I said to him, I said, well, how do you
well,
know?
That's crazy.
I said, how do you know that your stuff is making a difference then? you know, this was a guy presenting a talk, and I said, you're here telling us this, but how do you know that it's making a difference? He said, you can just tell at the end of the final session. Okay.
Well, the guy probably needs a wedgie for that, you know. One of the things that I encourage all my students to do, set goals for each session within your treatment plan that you've agreed upon, and at the end of every single session, how did that go today? How has today gone? Have we hit, have we hit the goal? Have we done what we set out to do in today's session? What else could I have done to make this better? And the problem is that people fear the response. Now, even if you get the worst possible response, you know what, Adam, I thought that was pretty shitty, that session today. I thought that you had disregard for this and your manner with that and so on. But the point is, the next session is going to be better as a result of you knowing that information. Heck, you know, as long as they're coming for the next one. But the point is that you've got to ask for that information and you've got to get that feedback. But, you know, and also you've got to measure what you are doing and have a look, you know, 3 months and 6 months and a year down the line and see what's happening. How else do you know if you are being effective? And if you've just assumed that something has gone well, then based upon the way someone is at the end of the session, without following it up effectively, I think that's foolish.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. And one of the things I think, I know something that made a huge difference to me in client work in general, whether it be framed as hypnotic or whether it's more the coaching stuff that I do, was, and this is a bit esoteric, I'm going to come from the more esoteric end of things, is just simply the idea of getting your ego out of the way, completely out of the way, and focusing 100% on serving the client. Is this serving the client? Is what I'm doing here serving the client, or is it serving my own ego, maybe my own fragile ego? So I know, going back, when I first started out, I had a desire to be good. I had this investment in being effective and all of this kind of stuff. So I didn't push. You know, I was very light in my touch around the end of the sessions and things like this. I didn't want to push the apparent change too much in case it fell apart, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But when I learned to get my ego out of the way more and go, actually, look, I want to really push this. Because if this shift that we've apparently got is that flimsy that it's going to fall apart just from a little prodding, maybe it's not all that robust. If you see what I mean, because the world isn't going to tread lightly, so I don't necessarily want to tread lightly. So I think that's a really important thing. I think if people get their ego out of the way, and are totally, you know, totally open to what happens. I'm a great believer in utilization. I'm a great believer in feedback. I think it's all good feedback. I think it's all useful. It's stuff that you can use, that the client can use going forward. And I set those frames explicitly around the work that I do, about making adjustments and looking for differences and then making further adjustments. And I set this feedback frame and this noticing of difference and exploring difference and different perspectives, which means anything is good because anything can be used. And we can both use it to then take things on to the next level, you know, as a kind of partnership.
Yeah.
That's probably a bit more of a flaky way of coming at things, because I'm more flaky compared to you.
Well, I suppose one of the things that I tend to say is, with regards to things like standardized protocols for use in therapy, which, you know, a lot of people have real issues with. And the beauty with regards to standardized protocols are that, you know, that you've got to be doing something absolutely, you know, you've got to be just doing something really, really wrong in order to not achieve a certain success rate and a certain level of achieving that. And so, you know, I think the cognitive behavioral hypnotherapy model and process and kind of armamentarium offers up a lot of techniques and strategies that come from a place whereby it's very client-centered to think, you know what, this technique, this process has been measured, and if I offer it with some degree of care and consideration, there's a really good chance I'm going to get a certain response and reaction. despite all of that, still measure it. I mean, there's a huge amount of ways to measure things. You know, ask people for a report. Ask them, you know, measure levels of effectiveness on, you know, their subjective experience. I mean, heck, I measure self-efficacy. You know, I don't use those terms, but I say to people, how capable do you feel you are now with regards to dealing with this issue? And on a scale of 0 to 100, and look at that throughout, depending upon the nature of the issue, and all the time be looking to measure and test and respond to feedback. And okay, I have a rather, you know, a more systematic, probably standardized version of how to go about doing that, but you know, it's a nice way of ordering a fairly unorderly mind that I have.
Yeah, I think it's really nice. I have to say that I used to be much more against standardized, protocols and practices. More against them. And I'm actually I have a lot more of an open heart towards them now. I always like to fall back on the yin-yang perspective, which is the call sitting on the fence, if you want. I value artistry. I do. I value skill. I value creativity. I value all of these things. And I also think, certainly from an NLP perspective, I think there's a lot of pressure put on people when they're first learning their craft to be artists.
This is one of my big things, you know. I mean, some of the biggest personalities in our field are people who have, you know, certain degree of artistry, skill and charisma. And, you know, how do you teach that? How do you teach that? People, you know, it becomes quite self-defeating that all the time I'm aspiring to be able to thread my language patterns together like, you know, X, Y and Z celebrity hypnotist or be able to use, you know, these certain skills and so on. In reality of a therapy room, you know, everybody becomes the same person again. And, you know, unless you are a really famous hypnotherapist or perhaps to a lesser extent, you know, when your client has been referred to you, you know, I can value artistry, but I also think that good quality critical thinking skills are just as creative as someone who is a real kind of artist, free spirit type of person. I think really good quality critical thinking skills. It goes hand in hand with this notion that people insist, you know, I must trust my gut feeling, and I must trust my instincts and intuition. And a lot of people think that that's related to artistry. And I'll say, I think that sometimes your gut feelings are not the kind of benevolent, all-seeing, all-wise being that they are portrayed as. You know, when someone stops smoking, for example, you know, he comes and sees a hypnotherapist and stops smoking, and then perhaps a week later is experiencing some stress or some kind of life situation which they're finding is a delicate balance with regards to wanting a cigarette and wanting to remain a non-smoker. And when they're there in the newsagents picking up their copy of the day local newspaper, there are those cigarettes there on the back shelf, and they're saying, "Woohoo, I'm over here. You know, come and get me." And that person's gut feelings are saying, "Cool, I really want one of those." Whereas quite clearly that's not in the best interests, you know, that those kinds of instincts and intuition aren't necessarily always in the best interest. And in fact, you know, with good critical thinking, intelligent reasoning, we could make our gut feelings or our instincts and intuition better informed and potentially make better decisions and choices for us. I don't want to dismiss it out of hand. That would be foolish. I'm not saying that. But, you know, I think that sometimes to treat gut feelings and intuition, for example, in that way, like the benevolent, all-seeing, all-wise being is probably a bit, is potentially limiting us. And you know, rather than just thinking of artistry in those terms, I'd like to say that, you know, if people also had critical thinking and, you know, and applied some logic and some intelligent reasoning from time to time, as well as everything else, you know, heck, Socratic questioning, then I think that would serve people just as well.
Yes, I'm a great advocate of critical thinking. I often, there was an idea from Ellman about bypassing the critical faculty. And I often say hypnosis is not just bypassing the critical faculty, it's engaging the creative faculty. But the critical faculty and the creative faculty, if we assume these things, these are not, you know, if we assume these labels for a moment, critical thinking and creative thinking, they're different thinking styles. They're both equally valid. It depends on how you're applying them, whether they're going to keep you, you know, maintain stasis in your life, or whether you can utilize them to help you change. And critical thinking skills, when you start really questioning your own assumptions about things, they can be, you know, really, really powerful for change. So, you know, helping people out with that. When it comes to intuition, that kind of thing, a lot of people have a magical view of intuition, like it's some kind of, you know, the universe is informing them somehow.
Yeah.
But I think, do you ever read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink?
Yes.
Well, there's a great story in there of the art expert who spots the fake. But the point is that the guy's been studying these statues for years.
Exactly.
He's got 20 years worth of expertise and knowledge. You know, he didn't just pick up wander into the field and pick up a statue and go, yeah, man, I'm just going to go my feeling on this.
No, quite.
This is a guy who's been in the field for absolutely years, has examined thousands of pieces, and has done a lot of engaged critical thinking and all kinds of, you know, it brought his cognitive faculties to bear upon his subject matter in so many ways and learned so much and so deeply about it. Yes, at that point, it gets to the point where he can say, this is a fake. And people will say, how do you know? I don't know yet. I just know. And then later on, it will come to him. Ah, that's what it was. But, you know, and I think, you know, so I'm a great believer in intuition, but I think there's a lot of pressure put on people. They might look and they hear the legend of Richard Bandler or the legend of Milton Erickson or whatever, and there's a lot of pressure put on people when they start out to have that kind of magic, that kind of artistry, that kind of skill, that kind of access to intuition, you know. And that said as well, I've seen Richard Bandler do some things that I've winced at, which I'm sure were based on his feeling and intuition. Maybe they were great things. Maybe it was just me personally wincing. Yeah, so I really do have more of a, what's the word? I have more friendliness towards the idea of simple, tried and tested processes. And something that you mentioned, you almost mentioned it in passing, I think, at Change Phenomena, was the idea, I can't quite remember how you put it, of plain speaking instructions versus language.
Yeah, you know, again, I'm not averse to some use of hypnotic language, but there is a, you know, Ericksonian and indirect language approach does have some inconsistency with the cognitive behavioral hypnotherapy model and some of the fundamental principles of it. First and foremost, there was a meta study done by Kirsch, Sapir-Steen and Montgomery, another study, and probably the more famous meta study of language patterns is Lynn, Neufeld and Mayer, and what they found was that there was no real difference in the efficacy of treatment gains or outcomes whether direct suggestions were used or whether indirect suggestions were used as far as a particular session is concerned. Now, there has been some disagreement, certainly within the academic. The academic environment, over the extent to which Erickson's approach can actually be compared to previous forms of hypnotism, or even whether it might be better being called something else other than hypnotism to avoid confusion. One of the key difficulties here is that indirect suggestions appear to function by means of a fundamentally different mechanism from traditional hypnotic suggestion. Stephen Lin, tends to suggest and what will explain suggestions in terms of them being a request for an imaginative experience. Hypnotic suggestions are a request for an imaginative experience and tend to be termed imaginative suggestions. And that tends to be quite central across the vast majority of research studies. By that definition, much of Ericksonian hypnotherapy is not necessarily employing hypnosis, and like I said, might potentially be better labeled indirect suggestion therapy, which may or may not turn out to be a useful therapy approach in its own right. But essentially, what a lot of researchers would say that it cannot claim to do so on the back of research on traditional direct suggestion therapy. So, for example, in a meta-analysis study, out of 57 randomized controlled trials that were reviewed, less than 20% were found to have employed predominantly indirect techniques. So, you know, is it fair then that people that use only Ericksonian hypnotherapy can claim to be working and using a technique that has the same evidence base as what they're referring to, you know, and claiming that that's absolutely the same as hypnosis and hypnotherapy? Moreover, it's often claimed by a lot of people promoting commercial workshops on Ericksonian hypnosis that the indirect approach is dramatically more effective than direct suggestion, especially with so-called resistant clients. And I think this is really, really more marketing hype. Because in the Lynn Neufeld Mayer study, of 29 independent studies that were comparing direct and indirect suggestion styles found that, you know, the two were broadly equivalent as far as their effectiveness was concerned, and they found no evidence across the studies that indirect suggestions improved responses to test items as Ericksonians would potentially predict, or that they somehow bypassed the subject's resistance. Within that meta-analysis, there are even indications that direct suggestions are superior to indirect suggestions in terms of modifying the subject's experience of hypnosis. You know, because a lot of people, you know, and when I talk about direct suggestions, we're not talking about authoritarian being ordered around, bossed. You know, these are just plain speaking imaginative suggestions. I think that a lot of people will find that the Ericksonian approach, you know, tends to have a slight disadvantage of perhaps being more complex, more time consuming, and less consistent with some general principles of evidence-based psychotherapy. Many popular books, workshops, I think, confuse students and potentially even mislead them about the nature of hypnosis and its role in psychological therapy, often making some claims that are completely inconsistent with research in the field of hypnotism. Erickson's approach emphasized the notion that I think has been really bastardized today, that the therapist should somehow try to circumvent clients' resistance by influencing them outside of their awareness using indirect means. It's kind of pulling the wool over their eyes approach to suggestion. And that typically emphasizes a need to deceive the client about the content of the suggestions that are supposedly given. And that notion in and of itself fundamentally clashes with some of the basic professional values of modern therapy, which it emphasized things like informed consent, collaboration, and educating of the client in open, plain speaking types of ways. The indirect approach that's characteristic of the followers of Erickson, you know, involves an element of deception and is inherently antagonistic to the CBH, the cognitive behavioral model and principle of collaboration, which is we're in this together. This is an open, honest, direct means of us communicating and is central. You know, Bourdain's working alliance, where there's agreement on processes. And if you look at, you know, even James Braid's original definition of hypnotism, which was in terms of focused attention on a particular idea or mental image, accompanied by a sort of conscious expectation that some response would happen as a result. You know, it was only much later that certain authors sought to portray hypnotism in more sort of obfuscating and mystifying terms, and something to do with talking to the unconscious mind of the client. So a lot of the kind of cognitive behavioral practitioners are sometimes a bit concerned that hypnotists encourage magical thinking or surround themselves with mystique. And it's certainly true of some approaches to hypnotherapy, but not all. But it has been a criticism leveled against the Ericksonian approach. Mm.
I think that's I'm absolutely fascinated by that, and that all rings true to me. And I still enjoy language patterns and all of that. And I do have a sense. I just put a video up the other day talking about where I helped my dad use some. I'm doing my air quotes now. I know this. Who was it who had a ban on it? Mark.
A change phenomena. I've been doing them. I did a load of air quotes, and then he said how much he disliked them in his presentation straight after mine. Yeah, great.
Was he eyeballing you, sending you daggers as he said it?
He was very lovely.
Yeah, I put a video up the other day, a true story of conversational hypnosis, which is using ideas from Ericksonian language, where I helped my dad out, ostensibly, apparently, in an effective piece of influence with a local government body. You know, they may have changed their mind anyway, who knows, but, you know, the structure was there. So I love the Ericksonian language, I love all of that stuff as well. And I agree with you 100%, there's something about the idea of I am the wizard. You know, in fact, there's that Erickson documentary that's out at the moment, The Wizard of the Desert, and there's this playing up of the idea of wizards and magic and all of this kind of stuff, which is nice and it's sexy, and I love that. I really do. It's very romantically engaging for me. So that engages half my mind, maybe half my brain, one hemisphere, if we roll with that myth. And on the other side, I'm also very interested in doing away with the mysticism of not having to leverage that, not having to leverage the woo-woo and being able to just go, boom, let's get in here and get some serious work done in helping you make this change that you want to have manifest in your life, you know, in helping you be the person that you want to be around this. You know, I really like that down-to-earth thing as well. You know, I'm going to fall back on my Taoist leanings with the yin-yang thing there.
I get that. What I've wanted to highlight here as clearly as I know how, is that the fundamental difference in outlook between the Ericksonian tradition in hypnotism and the cognitive behavioural approach that was originally really represented by Barber in the way in which I'm talking about it today. And this kind of more common sense and sceptical cognitive behavioural perspective is fairly dominant in the current research literature, although many hypnotherapists just continue to be drawn to the Ericksonian approach despite the lack of evidence to support it. And I think one of my, you know, I'm absolutely not a science Nazi. I'm not a science fascist that just says, you know, science at all costs. And what's more, you know, science is not about being right. I think a lot of people get their knickers in a twist about the use of the word science. Science is not about being right. You know, because if something comes along that supersedes existing evidence, then we yield to it. And it's about making the most accurate predictions that we possibly can and making responsible choices. Now, on PubMed, for example, you know, there are 13,000 hypnotherapy studies to draw upon. You know, not all of them are really good quality randomized controlled trials. There really isn't masses of those, but there are, you know, some really good quality reviews and meta-analyses and studies. And when we have so much evidence, I don't understand why it is that so much of the frontline hypnosis professionals are not aware of it and instead are focusing on something else that lacks it. And it doesn't seem to make common sense to me that in actuality would rather entrench themselves in dogma because they've been taught a particular way, have worked with a bunch of clients that way and seem to have got some results, and then get absolutely stuck with that and want to just argue and throw stones at me for questioning what they are doing.
I think what you're doing is fantastic. I love it. I'm fascinated by research. I really value science. I also tend to take a view that science is a particular methodology and it does contain with it inherent limitations. I think it's an imperfect tool, but in some sense it's the best tool that we've got. You know, and there are other approaches as well. I know that people can develop real skill. It may well be the case that Erickson was a kind of wizard of the desert and able to get fantastic changes happening, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, that may have been the case. There's a story of Herbert Spiegel. Was it Herbert Spiegel?
Herbert Spiegel of iRoll fame.
Yes, of iRoll fame. Have you heard this story about him sending one of his clients to Erickson?
No, I want to hear it, though.
Okay, so Herbert Spiegel had been working with this guy to help him stop smoking and it was failing utterly. The therapy just wasn't working at all. And the guy was on a business trip to Phoenix, so he thought, well, you know, Erickson's in Phoenix. He's got a great rep. Let's see if Erickson can do better than I can. So he contacted Erickson and said, would you see my client? So the story goes, this is just a story, obviously. And the guy flew in, went to his business meeting, went and saw Erickson and stopped smoking. So Spiegel was like, what has Erickson done here? You know, I really did my best for this guy and nothing shifted. And he said to the guy, you know, look, I've got to know, what did Erickson do that I didn't do? And he said, well, he was just there and he was just, this guy had been through so much and was in so much pain, yet all he wanted was for me to stop smoking. So I just, you know, I just couldn't carry on after that. So the point being is there's something about Erickson. People talk about Ericksonian techniques, but what were the Ericksonian techniques and to what degree was it really about Erickson's techniques and to what degree was it about Erickson in his entirety as a package? So even if Erickson was a highly effective change worker, unless you can identify and distill down a technique, you can't bring science to bear upon that. But neither can you teach it especially effectively either. You see, there's a double-edged sword there. This is the thing with artistry and great levels of artistry. That artistry is destroyed by scientific methodology. But if you can't break it down to test it, you know, there's some questions about the degree to which you can break it down and teach it. You see, because even with the NLP modeling idea, you're supposed to be stripping away the stuff that doesn't work and left with the stuff that does. So that implies testability. It implies it has to be there. You have to be doing the testing. What works, what doesn't? What are your protocols for testing? And I think this is one of the reasons why, for me, I advocate that everybody takes on responsibility for thinking critically and rigorously about the stuff that they do and testing it for themselves by their own criteria. You see, I think this is a really great thing if people do this. And the other choice is to let science types, researchers do the testing. But I still think, you know, I still think artistry carries a lot with it. And I often use the concept of, say, a great tennis player. If you get a great tennis player, it's very difficult to boil down to laboratory-tested tennis playing methods and say, these are the ones that work, so we're going to do this. That doesn't mean that there isn't a lot of scientific research that can inform the development of a tennis player very greatly, you know. So
yeah,
this is why for me I kind of see both sides of the story. I think you're probably a bit more on the science and evidence-based side than I am.
I am, you know, for me I also consider it to be be responsible and client-centered. That is, you know, it makes sense to me, and it seems to be a responsible choice to have something, to have my therapeutic treatment plan heavily punctuated with evidence-based treatments. Just makes me smile and makes me feel pleased and makes me feel secure that, you know, I'm making a good decision, and I'm agreeing on that decision with the client, and I like that. You know, with one of the, you know, a book that I know lots of people consider to be a real cornerstone of evidence-based approaches is the Oxford Book of Hypnosis, and the head hacking guys quote from it often, and so on. And there's a big chapter in there dedicated and devoted to the Ericksonian approach, and Stephen Langton does a really good job of presenting it and showing how perhaps, you know, his original approach is quite different to the approach that exists today. Nonetheless, I think some of the central components and the central points that I've made today probably mean that, you know, I'm not going to be averse to using the odd language pattern from time to time, but the central premise of it just dominating everything that I do. And you know, one of my very, very first hypnosis experiences in my initial NLP training ever, when I was watching Richard Bandler. I don't know if you've ever seen one of my favorite TV shows, Twin Peaks, and I love Twin Peaks. And after each show, I would go and discuss it with my friends, and we'd all say, that was brilliant, wasn't it? And we'd all say, yeah, it was just awesome. No one knew why, and no one knew what was going on. No one knew what was going on. It was like when I was a bit older then, and we were watching Lost. Everyone was saying, yeah, this is awesome. I haven't got a clue what's going on, but somehow it's awesome. And, you know, I had the same kind of thing on a lot of my NLP trainings, where the training comprised of story upon story and so-called metaphor. And people were in the tea breaks saying, this is brilliant. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm just going to have to sort of smile politely because I've got no idea what's going on. And upon suggesting such a thing, people were saying, ah, don't worry, it's all been unconsciously installed. And I was just thinking, you know what, that's not doing it for me. I need to understand, and I want to understand, and I want to be plain. And for that reason, I think I would like my clients to think the same. I'd like them to have a really cogent understanding as to what I'm suggesting. I want them to know the underpinning rationale behind the treatment plan. I want them to be able to understand and conceptualize the very nature of their own problem and know it, and know the reasons why I'm making certain decisions within the treatment plan that they are then agreeing upon. And, you know, even though I might offer up a therapist-led hypothesis with regards to the treatment plan, you know, that they're feeling involved in it because they understand what's going on. And to me, you know, that suits me. That suits the person that I am, and everything else. And like I said right at the very beginning, some of that may seem very, very sober, and some of that may seem very ordinary, but I think the longer term magic presents itself.
Yeah, I love that. That's brilliant. I really appreciate you bringing that perspective there, because I think there's I love that Lost metaphor and that Twin Peaks metaphor. It's great, but what the hell's happening? And I also that thing about understanding. You know, I always for a long time I was always trying to find ways of artfully framing things in ways that balance the magic and the mystery with a genuine desire I had to enlighten people. I didn't want to be deceiving my clients. I didn't want to be deceiving my students when I'm teaching hypnosis. I didn't want to be deceiving them into believing something which in my heart I felt was utterly phony, just for the sake of it being, you know, or not even phony, just didn't hold up to rigorous analysis. So I always thought, you know, for me, it was about trying to balance the two. I love the way you've just gone all out and gone, do you know what, let's demystify it. Totally, let's accept the sobriety of it and allow the magic to come through. Let it prove itself rather than have to be kind of hyped up and shrouded in mystery and all of that kind of thing. I think that's a very refreshing perspective. So really, really interesting to hear that. We've got a very short amount of time. There's a whole bunch of stuff that I would love to add there around hypnosis, Ericksonian hypnosis versus old school, maybe more direct hypnosis. I'm putting air quotes around hypnosis when I'm saying both of those, Ericksonian hypnosis and direct hypnosis, using extensive air quotes. there's a few questions here that people sent in ahead of time that I think will be worth going through. First of all, I'm going to mention there's a question from Jay Arno or Arnott here. I'm not quite sure how that's pronounced. And it's a question about how it fits with it's a question about Stephen Gilligan stuff. And I think we both talked about this ahead of time, and we don't really know Stephen Gilligan stuff, do we? So it wouldn't be smart for us to comment on that. Should we skip that?
A massive apology to Jay. And that is that, one of the things I said to James, just as we were, just as I was struggling to actually get my way onto this call, was that within my own PhD, examining the efficacy of self-hypnosis, I've seen and looked at the vast majority of academic approaches to self-hypnosis, and as a result, have probably not looked around the periphery a huge amount. And I'm sad to say that I'm aware of Stephen Gilligan, but I'm not aware of his approach to self-hypnosis, and don't feel qualified enough to really answer that rigorously.
And I'm in the same position, although I haven't got a PhD to fall back on.
Yeah, I know. I was only saying that to sound clever.
It worked.
Easily have made my point without mentioning that without mentioning my PhD there. That's just smug and conceited of me. I apologise. Hypnosis without trance, listeners.
It was seeding, an example of seeding, just demonstrating you are aware of Ericksonian methods.
Yeah, that's it.
When the time is appropriate. But we've got a couple of other questions here. So the next question here is from George. George is in Albany, New York. We have a properly international audience here today. We've got people from Canada, Berlin we've got here. We've got Boston, Massachusetts. We've got Florida on the line here. We've got Malmesbury and Wiltshire. There's lots going on. And Alexander Hartman's on the line here. Alex in Germany. Hi, Alex. How are you? Anyways, let me get onto the question. Empowering self-efficacy is the ultimate goal, but can't that simply include making the decisions to show up and making sure you do so? We can ask for help from the outside. That's okay, because it takes a lot to make that decision and follow through. I'm thinking about the power hypnosis model. This is a term I use for kind of very dominant patriarchal hypnotists. Accepting the change because I showed up and the hypnotist put me into hypnosis, not because I necessarily understand what's taking place. I accept that it's taken place. Sure, what the question is here. If you've got a take on the question,
I would probably hand the vast majority of that question over to yourself. However, one of the things that I did want to say is, with regards to my own particular model, I would rather than people just change because they showed up and the hypnotist put them into hypnosis, I think was the term, I'd rather equip that person and have them, you know, develop some self-efficacy, as we've discussed, in some depth. I would rather that they felt that it was a collaborative process, that they were as actively involved in it as I am.
Yeah. And for me, with the work that I do these days, as I say, I do a lot more coaching than I do therapy-based stuff, because I like doing it more. And the people I work with are already showing up really keen and really proactive and in a real ownership position, so to speak. One of the things I value greatly is I value the faculty of consciousness. I really value it. I think it's a fantastic faculty. I know there are people out there arguing, oh, there's no such thing as consciousness and all of this kind of thing. And, you know, we aren't really free to choose, so it's all an illusion and this, that, and the other. But I value, you know, even if it is an illusion, it seems to be a powerful illusion, one that we can make use of, which seems self-contradictory. I value consciousness. I value choice. I value us bringing higher levels of awareness to things and recognizing where we can make differences, where perhaps we were unaware of where we could make differences before. This is one of my arguments, or one of my discomforts with the deifying of the unconscious mind. Like, everything conscious is bad, is no good. The unconscious is the seat of all wisdom, and I often call it the genie in the bottle model. We rub the genie and out comes the genie of the unconscious, and we ask it in the right way and it makes the change. You know, I don't find that generative. I don't find that useful. I prefer my clients to switch up their consciousness, the term that I use, to start becoming a better witness to their own processes, start becoming aware of where they are doing things and where they can make differences. And this way they're becoming empowered. You know, they're becoming empowered. It's a cheesy term. The self-development world uses it a lot, but they are becoming more empowered and more connected to where they can choose. So I often say, you know, and this is an influence from my mentor, Steve Chandler, one of my mentors, I want people to stop identifying with who they think they are and their stories about themselves and their thinking and all of this, and start identifying with the I that can be aware and can make choices and can do things differently and learn new things. You know, so this is where I'm at. And I'm really into people learning to so people are as they are because of what happened in the past. But the past is gone, and the future is dictated by right now, the choices they make right now, the attributes they take on board right now, the way they shift their way of being right now. So for me, I'm really into kind of present stuff. What's going on with your head? Where are you? Let's look at what you're doing in your head, the skills you already have, developing new skills, this kind of thing. I find that's a generative and empowering way of helping people to make changes, so they don't have to be the victim of their past. They don't have to be the victim of all these stories and all of this kind of thing. There's so much I could say on that, but let's move on. Shall we do an extra 4 minutes to get onto Caesar's question? Because we've got this one last question.
Yeah, let's do it.
And Caesar is now in Denver, Colorado. Well done on your move, Caesar. I hope you're having a fantastic time there. We'll have a conversation at some point. So Caesar is asking, in teaching the client that they can do that change work process on their own, how far should I go with the empowering of the client without transferring the session into a hypnosis training? Do you have any considerations about the level of chunked down information that the client can know without it damaging the results of the change work session that they are there for?
Okay. There's a couple of things I'll say on this. I'm probably sounding a little bit of a pedant, but where it says in teaching the client that they can do the change work process on their own, of course, you know, that they have a degree of responsibility for the change, but they're not doing it all on their own. You know, the reason they are seeking out the assistance of a therapist or a coach is because, you know, they're going to do it collaboratively. But you know, a lot of it is coming from them, and they absolutely must accept some degree of responsibility. As far as how far should I go with empowering the client without transforming the session into a hypnosis training, I think that probably, if you look at the value of psychoeducation and the support for psychoeducation, and I mean, Michael Yapko, who's an Ericksonian sympathizer, as well as Irving Kirsch and a wide number of, you know, really strong academics, talk about response sets and educating the client in such a way that, you know, initial sessions very often do almost become a hypnosis training. Certainly a lot of my sessions seemingly turn into, you know, big chunks of them resemble self-hypnosis training. And I see nothing wrong with that. I think I think that's wonderful. It's the essence of much of what we do. And with regards to, and I don't think that any of that damages the results of the session that they're there for. Absolutely, I don't think any of that. I mean, I don't know how on earth it could damage the results. You know, the fact that you're empowering someone, teaching them, and having them become aware and skilled and developed and informed, I think that's probably about all that I have to say on that.
I think.
It's a great question. I understand where you're coming from, and I hope that I've answered as thoroughly and plainly as I can.
I think you have, and I think Caesar always does ask great questions. That's one of the reasons I wanted to get to his question. I think there's an idea. I'm making a bit of a guess as to where Caesar's coming from. There's an idea, certainly, and I think it comes through the NLP world and maybe the Ericksonian world as well. I've certainly been exposed to it through these areas. That it's, again, that idea that the client can't know, that the conscious mind will interfere with the unconscious programming. This is another idea, which, of course, is totally at odds with your approach and your model. So I guess it's just not an issue for you, because that isn't an assumption that you're working from in the first place. The client...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting thing, because I think it goes straight to the core of that thing, of the difference between bringing the client in their entirety into the process versus trying to keep extensive parts of the client, i.e. their conscious thinking, this, that, and the other, out of the process, so they're none the wiser, they just change. And this kind of old idea that it has to be, the unconscious has to be uninterfered with, otherwise the conscious mind will pick apart the change. I've heard it put in this way before. And I think that way of thinking is immediately resultant from the underpinning assumptions about how hypnosis works, how change works, how human beings work. And I think that you're coming from a very different set of assumptions, which is what makes it so refreshing.
Yeah, and you know what? One of the things that's so beautiful about our field that a lot of people think actually is the thing that's quite ugly about it. A lot of people think it's quite ugly that there are so much disagreements within the field, when actually, if we look at, you know, really, really good quality, respectful debates and discussions, you know, we all benefit from the spoils of that. If you look at the 1970s was a really flourishing time for the field of hypnosis research, and there were what were referred to as theory wars. This is where the non-state proponents really took a grip of the academic world as far as hypnosis is concerned. And, you know, a lot of people see some fairly lively debates and discussions, although probably not quite as lively as kind of modern online phenomena. But, you know, we can all benefit from the spoils of those discussions and look to develop, advance, and inform ourselves. And even if people disagree vehemently with the things that I have to say today, even if they disagree with things that you have to say, you know, I still hope that, you know, as a hypnosis professional, full stop, we can still be friends.
That's a wonderful sentiment, and I know you always mean that genuinely, which is a fantastic thing. Adam, we've gone over by 7 minutes. I said I was going to be as punctual as possible. Now, I just want to say, before we finish up, that you teach this approach to hypnosis. You teach cognitive behavior hypnosis. So there's an opportunity there, if people are interested, to learn more from you directly about that. Do you have somewhere that people can go and find out more?
If you visit adam-eason.com, Adam Eason with a hyphen in the middle .com, on the seminars and training section, that the drop down menu has the details of my 5-day course. If you've got some experience and some training already, it serves as a conversion diploma. The first couple of days are really hardcore theory, I'll be honest. But then there's a huge amount of resource, and it's ultimately rewarding. I think it changes things for people. I've only got one date remaining this year, but we're going to add a bunch of dates because of the popularity of the course. We're going to add a bunch of dates in and around the different environments around the UK. And you know, if you're interested and you fancy me coming to your part of the UK, then send me a message. Likewise, you know, if you disagree with anything that I've said today, or something has resonated well with you, you know, send James messages that he can pass on to me, or alternatively, you know, contact me from my website or from my Facebook page. My Facebook page, by the way, is Adam. A lot of people stumble across my personal account and become offended when I say that if I don't know you, I won't be your friend. But, you know, if you want to connect with me on Facebook, it's just Hypnotist Adam, you know, facebook.com/hypnotistadam. And you can send me questions and queries and learn about stuff that we do from there.
That's fantastic. So, Adam, thank you very much for taking the time out this
evening. It's a real, real privilege, as always. Always love talking to you, James.
Love talking to you also. Really enjoyed it. And I think that's been incredibly valuable for people listening in. As Adam says, if you have any further questions, contact him directly. Or you can use, if you're on the blog page, you can use the comment section at the bottom of the blog page. And I'll pass on any messages to Adam from there. So thank you all for being here. Thank you for listening in, and until we next speak, have a wonderful time.
Best wishes.
Oh.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.